This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the phenomenon of Oprah Winfrey. Her empire includes television, movies, publishing, and the internet. She's the country's wealthiest African American, but far from the country's wealthiest white American. My guest this afternoon is University of Illinois history professor Juliet Walker. She's teaching a course at the U of I this semester titled Oprah Winfrey, the Tycoon. The course doesn't give credit to students for watching Oprah or reading her magazine. Students instead are asked to think and write about Oprah's business success within the context of the history of black entrepreneurship. It offers an opportunity for students to examine the impact of race on the economic progress or lack of progress of African Americans. Listeners, I encourage your questions and comments for Professor Walker. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Professor Juliet Walker is an award-winning historian who specializes in black business history, antebellum African American history, and African diaspora studies in black business. She earned her PhD from the University of Chicago and did postdoctoral work at Harvard University. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Walker, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. This course has generated a great deal of interest from the media. Has that taken you by surprise at all?
Yes, it has. I had no idea that there would be so much interest. Of course, there's interest in Oprah, but I didn't think there would be interest in Oprah Winfrey, the Tycoon, History 298. So, yes, it was really a wonderful surprise, however.
Yeah, yeah. I suspect one of the first questions you're asked in regards to Oprah Winfrey, the Tycoon, is what is it about Oprah that has led to such success for her?
That's a question, at least the answer I'm exploring at this point in time in a book that I'm writing on Oprah. Oprah was the first in terms of what she has done, not only as an entertainer, but also as an entrepreneur. And in this sense, and I guess this is a reason why Time magazine had her listed as one of the most 100 influential people of the 20th century. So certainly that calls for some kind of examination. And of course, people have asked the question, history. I thought history was a record of the past, but anything that has happened in the past is history. What you must do with history, however, is show the processes of change over time. You have to be able to show cause and effect relationships. For example, in 1986, the Pulitzer Prize winning in history went to a book on the history of the American space industry. that's relatively recent. In this instance, with Oprah Winfrey, she provides a prism by which we can look mm-hmm. at many things, one being the intersection of race, gender, and class. Also, at the same time, it provides its a basis to look at where Black Americans stand, especially in relationship to business activity.
Mm. So she is a way we can look at past, present, and maybe even sort of get an idea of where we're headed.
As a historian, I'm not going to go that far, but in 2004, Oprah will be 50 years old, and I think she's, at this point, has accomplished only half of what she intends
right,
to do.
Right.
But as far as projecting what she's going to do in the next 50 years after 2004, I think perhaps considering her interests in various humanitarian endeavors, that she perhaps might be able to do more than what she has done. One of my students in the Oprah Winfrey seminar, when suggesting what could Oprah do that she hasn't done as far as building her her entertainment conglomerate, suggested that perhaps she Oprah would buy a WBA Women's Basketball Association team. I mean, this is what you see with a lot of the leading male entrepreneurs. They go out and buy a sports team. I don't think this is going to be the case with Oprah because of what her focus and emphasis are, and particularly that is the empowerment of women.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she's only 40-something, and I wish her a long life.
Absolutely.
And I expect her influence to grow as she grows older. I mean, here she's yes. just reaching the height of her powers.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And that's another thing which is exciting. Here is a woman who was born 1954, the same year of the Brown decision. And when you look at her life, you see the extent to which Blacks have begun to expand participation in the new economy. But at the same time, the picture of Black business is very, very bleak, notwithstanding government reports that will say minority businesses are growing, increasing, expanding in number and business receipts. This is true, but it is not the case with African-American businesses. African-American business receipts amount to only 0.04% of total American business receipts. African-American businesses are literally at the bottom in terms of business receipts and in terms of numbers. But what Americans look at would be the wealth and success of the nation's superstar entertainers and superstar sports athletes, and not giving particular attention to the rest of Black America as far as business is concerned. And it's not just the fact that we have occupational mobility. That is important. But at the same time, getting to the emphasis on Oprah within the context of Black business history, this is a relatively unexplored field. People have looked at some Black who have been in business at different times. But I don't think anyone can imagine the history of a country, and there are some 37 million Blacks in this country, which is about the same as the population of Canada. But yet this is a history which the experiences and the tradition of economic self-help have been ignored. We have a history in Black America of the social history, the political history, but where is that history of economic self-help? And it's important because many people say that Black Americans do not succeed in business because we lack this tradition of business participation. But there's a whole history that goes back to the 17th century. With the beginning of slavery in this nation, there were also Blacks involved in business. So that middleman theory or immigrant theory that you rise up and succeed in business, that hasn't worked for African Americans. First of all, we are not immigrants. So in that instance.
So we have the history of African American business going back hundreds of years, but we're still seeing a lack of economic parity.
Absolutely.
If economic parity was tomorrow to become a national goal, how would we begin the journey to make progress toward that goal?
That's a very complex, complicated question. And I'm sure the person who will be able to answer it will win the Nobel Peace Prize. But since I'm not in that category, the first thing, of course, would be to eliminate racism in this country. And instead of the elimination of racism, we seem to see the intensification. W.E.B. Du Bois, the first black to get a PhD from Harvard, said at the beginning of the 20th century that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. We're at the beginning of the 21st century, and the problem of the color line is expanding because of changing demographics in American life. The elimination of racism will have to be the first step. There have been other suggestions, for example, with reparations that America owes black America. And I certainly agree with that. The historian Edmund P. Morgan emphasized that America bought its independence with the labor of slaves. That is, a nation doesn't go to war if it doesn't have money. And just about all that was selling in the American colonies at the time of the Revolution and even before were slave-produced commodities. That is, the economic basis and foundation of the United States was built primarily with the sale of goods produced by slaves on international markets. That was the basis of the pre-industrial economy that provided eventually the American economy to expand. So you had almost 250 years of people who worked without pay. But when I talk about reparations, I'm not talking about, everybody getting $100,000. I'm talking about the kinds of funds that could be used to guarantee every young black American a college scholarship. For example, from the kindergarten, children should be told, if you even get a C average, you will go to college. If you get an A average, maybe you can go to the University of Illinois. But you will be able to go to college. People need dreams and need hopes. Let me give you an example. We're talking about, at least the government will tell us, that there was a decline in black poverty by some 700,000 people, 700,000 blacks. But what is the measure of poverty? For a family of three, it's $13,000. So if you have $13,001, then you are no longer poor. So we have to begin to look at just what is needed in terms of economic advancements for blacks. It takes $30,000 to keep one individual in prison, but yet a single mother with two children would have to support all of them on a little above $13,000 and not be considered in poverty. So there has got to be equity in education, even in the kinds of employment that would be available for blacks. For example, in the high-tech industry, people are saying, well, it's not that we don't support diversity, but, you know, there aren't enough blacks who have an education in high-tech. And so we're beginning to see a vicious cycle that's going on. And I think what America has to begin to realize, especially, you know, with the changing population, is that as long as there's this racial divide between black and white, racism will continue. And one example is the case of the American plane in China. And one of my colleagues sent around information that has been distributed on the racist acts that have been directed against Chinese Americans, saying that, you know, we are Americans and yet we've been subjected to people, even people in the entertainment media, suggesting that Chinese should be rounded up and put into internment camps or relocation camps like the Japanese during World War II. And yet, I do not believe, and this is my own opinion, that Chinese Americans have been very active in promoting civil rights for all Americans, as has been the case with Black Americans, with the various civil rights groups and that have been in existence. So people, minorities, need to pull together to eliminate racism, because it's not going to be enough for a Hispanic or a Chinese person or Asian person to say, well, you know, white Americans only like blacks, dislike blacks, they don't dislike us, so we'll stay away from it. It's got to be a situation in which every American, not just minorities, but majority Americans, white Americans, begin to see that racism as it exists has to be fought on all levels, and even with all races. Jesse Jackson, for example, with his Rainbow Coalition, attempted to bring about not an end to poverty, but to point out the impoverished whites. And as you know, there are more poor whites in this nation than there are blacks. Well, there are more whites in this nation. But at the same time, there is a larger percentage of blacks who are poor, even though the largest numbers of impoverished people are white. So as Black Americans, we are not eating up the federal funds. They're going to not only to poor whites, but also to corporations who get tax cuts. And so in reference to that question, we have to begin to eliminate racism in all areas. And it's not enough to say that we are committed to diversity. So many companies say that. But being committed to diversity and equity in employment and salaries are two different things.
Yeah. Well, a moment ago you mentioned Brown versus Board of Education, 1954, the year Oprah was born. And of course, one of the famous lines in that decision was that the school should be desegregated with all deliberate speed, which, you know, is just sort of getting at right at what you're talking about here. It's not enough to say, you know, this is our goal. You got to move on it.
Yeah, and that desegregation has not, or integration, it all depends on your perspective. That has not occurred primarily because of the limited integration or desegregation in American housing patterns. With the 1968 Civil Rights Housing Act, where Black Americans lived virtually anywhere they could afford, this is when we began to see the changing color of the American cities. As Black Americans moved into what was were formerly white neighborhoods, whites moved out, they moved out to the suburbs, blacks moved out to the suburbs. Now, in Chicago, for example, you have literally a black suburb surrounding the cities, the Chicago, and then further on, we're having the development of exurbia, you know, beyond the suburbs. I think an example would be as to what's happening, and I hope it doesn't lead to what some people might refer to as the Balkanization of America. But when you look at Florida, for example, in Miami, in which the population is literally 60-70% Hispanic, primarily Cubans, so many white Americans have left and they moved north. And the Cuban population followed. Whites are moving to North Carolina. So even in those instances when minority groups do secure the funds to live in a particular community, whites move out. Perhaps this is not going to be a problem by 2050 when non-Hispanic whites, you know, that's the new census designation, will probably be in a minority, like 49.5%, something like that.
Yeah. I want to pull this back toward Oprah, because that's where we started. And,
yes.
And that's how I've, you know, promoted the program in terms of this wonderful phenomenon of Oprah Winfrey. My mother loves Oprah. Mm-hmm. My grandmothers, had they been alive, would have loved Oprah. Mm-hmm. What is her appeal to women? Her audience is women. And interestingly enough, it's a white audience, isn't it?
What
yes,
if?
Yes, it is.
So
almost
what if
98, and that's looking at the TV, you know, studio
yeah.
audience.
So what's that about?
That's about a lot of things. But one could be, first of all, Oprah is doing what she can do best. And that's what she has experienced herself. Her focus is on the empowerment of women. And Black Americans have asked along the way, what about the empowerment of Blacks? So we begin to see whether or not, take, for example, if Oprah had started out with her TV show, this show is about the empowerment of African Americans, and we make up almost 13% of the population. I'm sorry to say, I don't think that Oprah would have succeeded. But getting back to what Oprah does best, what she does is in terms of empowering women. When she first started out, Phil Donahue was her competitor. He was a serious individual. He asked serious questions and had leading statesmen on to solve the problems of the world. And then Oprah comes along. For example, Oprah had a show. And since this was on television, I think I can repeat it, in which she had a female gynecologist. Mm-hmm. And they eventually got around to the issue of sexual satisfaction. Oprah raised the question, and see here again, this is what Oprah is able to do. She raises the kinds of questions that are in the minds of her female viewers and listeners. Oprah raised the question, does size make a difference? This is what brought her to national attention. It was not just the question, and the gynecologist gave her, the answer that they usually give. Oprah's response was something to the effect, well, I don't know about that. Bring a big one home to mama. I mean, this is what she said on television. And it's documented and cited, and this went all over the United States. Who is this woman? And that was a key to her initial success. I mean, that initial success was based on what media critics now identify as trash TV. Then it moved on to confessional TV. And then Oprah in the early 90s moved on to the kind of TV based on Renew Your Spirit, because she said she was not going to spend the rest of her life doing trash TV. But even in doing so, she still has continued to maintain her market, those people who listen to her. So I think that's one factor that accounts for her success, that people like Oprah. She has a kind of charisma that's there. So I guess you're saying, but you're still not dealing with the question of what about the Black TV audience? Well, Chicago is my home. And so I watched Oprah, when she first came to Chicago. I remember it was a parade on January the 1st, New Year's Day. And Oprah was marching. Well, maybe it wasn't January the 1st, but it was some parade. And Oprah was introducing herself to Chicago. And Black Americans, oh, a Black woman with a TV show. Oh, this is wonderful. Okay, once the show got on the road, and that was the time when Oprah would go into the audience, which was the format at that time, and ask questions, and people might break out in tears and cry, and Oprah would hug them, the famous hugs. But in the black press, Black talk radio, the question, why isn't Oprah hugging more Black people? So the question is, that hasn't been answered. I haven't answered it, but one can certainly say that Oprah has been very active in her philanthropy in supporting Black education, and as to the other question, In fact, in the course, one of my students, and I was surprised because in looking at the television audience, most of the women seem to be in their 30s, 40s, professional women. So I just wasn't thinking that young people were looking at the show. And I was talking to one of my students. In fact, all of the students have been looking at the show since they were kids, because their mothers were looking at the show. So, you know, they have literally grown up with Oprah. But I thought, but I wasn't thinking about that. And so this student was perhaps 19 or 20, and she said, oh, young people just love Oprah. They just love Oprah. And I said, really? Are you sure? So what we did, we constructed a survey, and the 15 students went out. They had each 50 questionnaires to ask students, you know, making a distinction between male and female, even with race, to, you know, to see how students felt about Oprah. And most of the women liked the show. They liked her. They liked the topics. The men, you know, well, that's a woman show kind of thing. Well, if the topic is interesting, I'll look at it. But So it's interesting, this whole aspect of racial appeal. But we have to look at how America views black people. There's some black people that America loves, white America. And these are the ones that are so successful. White Americans love Michael Jordan. They love retired General Secretary of State Colin Powell. They love Tiger Woods. They love Oprah. But let these people, and Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor, walk down any street in the black community looking like an ordinary black person, that's the way they would be treated. And that's not a very positive way. If they were in a car and they drive up, standing on the corner waiting for a bus, and cars came to a stoplight, people would begin looking around to see if their doors were locked. And in fact, Oprah had that experience. She was in New York, just, you know, there. She wasn't walking, visiting, and she didn't have her makeup on, some sweats and something. She looked just like an ordinary black person. And so she happened to walk past a jewelry store and look in. I said, well, you know, she could afford to buy anything there. And in many New York stores, you have to ring the bell to get in. So Oprah rang the bell and rang the bell, and the door was not open. And so she went back and wrote the, you know, the president of the company. So what does this say? It almost says that as long as black people continue to serve white people, you know, to the best of their ability, that they have some kind of success. And this is why so many of, and it gets back to human capital skills, social capital, and cultural capital. That is, especially take the music industry with hip hop that grew out of black culture, black diaspora culture. And people have, blacks have profited from that. So Oprah is part of that. When we look at black business in America, one significant aspect of it with the new economy would be the spectacular financial success of black entertainers and black sports stars. In my book, The History of Black Business in America, Capitalism, Race, Entrepreneurship, I've identified three phases in the rise of black corporate America in the 20th century. Now we're in the 21st, and there's a new phase, and that could be seen in the number of black businesses that are almost like incubators, and they're being sold off to large multinational corporations. But here again, Oprah is distinct because there's nothing she can do. She's certainly not going to sell herself off. You know, Oprah has commodified herself.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, thinking about her magazine, Oprah is on the cover of every magazine.
That's good. That's good market strategy.
I know, but yeah. You know, like the other big publishing media maven that comes to mind is Martha Stewart,
mm-hmm.
and their magazines are so different, and their approach to business seems to me to be very different. Mm-hmm. But you know, here Oprah is Oprah. She's the product.
Mm-hmm.
know?
Yeah, she has commodified herself and been successful at it. And another thing, I think that is one of the best magazines, not one, that is just about the best women's magazine, the Oprah magazine. When you read the others, you know, it's the same thing I've been reading for decades. I literally stopped reading them except for Essence. And then with Oprah's magazine, there's some meat in there that I don't get. And it's the most successful magazine as well. But here again, that gets back to Oprah's expanding media conglomerate. That's a joint venture, you know, with Hearst Publication. And she has had joint adventures, for example, with her Occidental Cable TV, as another example. And there are others.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guest this afternoon is University of Illinois History Professor Juliet Walker. She's teaching a course at the U of I this semester titled Oprah Winfrey, the Tycoon. Listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation, you're more than welcome. We're happy to make some space for you here with your questions and comments in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you're listening across Illinois or Indiana, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Her magazine is beautifully done. It includes a little bit of everything. And here once again, you know, she's doing, you know, the empowerment thing.
Mm-hmm.
She's doing the latest is joy.
Yes.
She's into, you know, celebrating yourself,
yes,
and your family, and here at the bottom of this cover, we're celebrating free time, everyday magic, hot music, cool beach things, sex and chocolate. So it's a little bit of everything. It's really quite an interesting mix, and we've got our phone lines are all lit up. Let's go and let's talk with some listeners. First, we're going to go to a listener on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
This is very interesting. I hate to reduce things to overly simplistic terms, especially when I'm dealing with someone as accomplished as Dr. Walker. But I see a common thread between the acceptance of Tiger Woods, Oprah Winfrey, who's source of a concern today, Michael Jordan, Sammy Davis Jr., the late Sammy Davis Jr., people of that ilk, people of color, because I think if historically they are distinguished from, say, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Jesse L. Jackson Sr., the current president of the NAACP, Julian Bond, the chairman of the board, because they're non-threatening to the majority race community in this country. They, in that vein, will prosper and be rewarded for by people like Serena Williams, Venus Williams, and their eccentric father, will suffer the sting of being called by use of the N-word. This is unfortunate, but this is what I think the relationship between African-Americans and whites have been for many years. There is a good black, and then there is a militant or non-good black. Oprah is a good black because she does champion the cause of women, and the women that have predominantly benefited from affirmative action in these programs are white women. And I have said in the barbershop locally, well, almost to a person, African-American men, when the Oprah show has come on, have turned it off for the simple reason that there are not enough blacks on Oprah's show and it doesn't appeal to black audiences. And that's my comment, Dr. Walker.
I agree with you. What more can I say? This, and I think I emphasize that that point that you made, that those blacks who do succeed are those who are doing so on the basis of their particular skills, their human capital skills, that is, in entertainment, in sports, doing things that other people have not been able to do. So they're lifted up to be superstars in that sense. And I think you mentioned Michael Jordan, for example. While he was playing, there was criticism about Nike workers being exploited over in, you know, Pacific Rim countries who worked in the factories. And people asked, well, Michael, what are you going to do about it? And he said, yes, 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 as soon as I retire, I'm going to go over there and see for myself, see what they're doing. Well, I think it's been a couple of years since Michael has retired, and I haven't heard anything about him going over there to to make statements about the working conditions of people. So it's true in that sense that those blacks who don't complain, who literally support the status quo in terms of the ways in which they do things, are the ones who get ahead. They've taken, you would think, their cues from Booker T. Washington, who has said to black Americans back in 1895, do not let your grievances overshadow your opportunities. So when there were these opportunities, these blacks have capitalized on them, while the rest of us sit around complaining. And consequently, that's where we are.
Let's take another call. This one on the toll-free line, line 4 in Indiana. Good afternoon. Is there a caller there? Okay, I don't think so. Let's go on to another listener, this one on line 2 in Eureka. Good afternoon.
I'm going to risk asking the same question, but I think it establishes a valuable point you've made. That, do I understand you right in saying that Oprah is allowed to succeed because she fulfills the stereotype of this person can pull themselves up by their bootstraps and they can make it, therefore maybe America isn't such a bad place and she fulfills the values of corporate America?
Yes, and this is what the empowerment, women empowerment, is about with Oprah. If you look, read her magazines, if you listen to her show, if you look on her internet website, this is the thing that if you believe, you can achieve. And this is the focus. Well, it's, you know, it's easy to tell, well, to tell women, but it's very difficult to tell black people that all you have to do is try, and you will succeed, because no one historically has worked harder than black people. So you have to really be a special kind of black person to be able to succeed by utilizing your skills and not complaining. Let me also add something, too. We talk about, for example, occupational mobility, and I'm looking at what you could call white corporate America, the Fortune 500 companies, in which there are only 3 black CEOs. And these people, here again, we have to take into consideration personality, character, and these kinds of things. But what is so interesting about that is that you find the same parallels that existed during the institution of slavery, that those blacks in the South who were able to take whatever was being dished out, they were able to perhaps get a little more than those blacks who did not. So one has to make a choice, and we get back to what is it to be an entrepreneur. It's a person who's a risk taker, it's a person who is an innovator, and a person who comes up with a new product. And Oprah came up with the kind of product that sells in America. I don't think, for example, if, Diana Ross or Halle Berry, for example, could have that kind of show, because I don't think they could give off the kind of warmth and joy that Oprah projects. So Oprah has commodified herself in a way that other people have not been able to do. That's part of what she is as an individual. And, of course, there are other factors that come into play.
Thank you.
You're Thanks welcome. For the call. Next we go to that caller, I think, that might have been waiting for us previously on line 4 in Indiana. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. I just wonder if you're guest might well not know that her title might be considered racist. Hello?
Yes? What title is that?
The title of the book is Oprah Tycoon, right?
Oprah Winfrey, the Tycoon, is the title of a course that Professor Walker is teaching here at the University of Illinois in the history department.
Well, anyway, I think the course title then might be considered racist. You know, the term coon is a disparaging remark about Negro or African American.
I don't think we need to go any further there. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn, our guest this afternoon, University of Illinois History Professor Juliet Walker. Other calls are welcome, 333-9455, 800-222-9455.
Let me say something.
Yeah,
the course
okay.
is Oprah the Tycoon, spelled T-Y-C-O-O-N. And a tycoon is defined as a very successful, very wealthy business person. And since Oprah is the wealthiest, according to the Forbes 500 as of September 2000, she stands in the same classification of other tycoons in American life, where you have Rockefeller, you have Ford, you have Carnegie. You had John Jacob Astor, who, by the way, was the first American millionaire. So that's what it is. It's Oprah the Tycoon, Oprah the rich entrepreneur.
Okay. I don't know how anybody could misunderstand that, but there we have it. Oprah's television program is seen in virtually every U.S. market. Where is it not seen?
That's a good question. I never thought about it. I'm sure that because it's on one of the national networks. Do you mean worldwide or just in the United States?
In the United States. I mean, it's in virtually every U.S. market. So maybe there would be a market where that network, is it CBS that it's on? Is that, or, oh, okay, we're stumped. But anyway, I was just curious about that. You know, She's almost everywhere in the United States, but not quite everywhere. But then if you look at where she is in the world, mm-hmm. she's everywhere from A to Z. And there's a list of countries that you provided us where her program is available. Afghanistan?
Yeah, it's incredible. The Oprah Winfrey Show is shown in 113 different countries. And in fact, one of my students, who is a graduate student, and although it's an undergraduate course, she's taking it as an independent study. And she's doing a research paper on the impact of Oprah in Kenya, in different places. And the Kenyan students that she has met at the University of Illinois, in addition to other African students, love Oprah. They love Oprah, and this gets back to the comment that was made earlier by one of the listeners that perhaps not too many African Americans love Oprah.
But
so
Africans.
That's going to be something I'm going to explore. Why is it that Oprah, you know, is so beloved by Africans on the continent, and then you have some African Americans here who perhaps are not. Particularly excited about her as an entertainer.
Very interesting. Who is taking your class?
There are 15 students in the class, and as I have told people that my audience, listen to me. my audience of 15, student body, it's one third male. Okay. So there are 15 students in the class. And to break it down racially, I hope this is, can be politically correct. There are 5 African American students, 1 Hispanic student, and the other students are white. There are 5 male students,
right.
and the others are female. So it's a good mix. The course is also interdisciplinary in focus. And what I've tried to do with the students' research paper is to have them, because most are juniors and seniors, draw on their own discipline in order to explore Oprah within the topic. One student, you mentioned Martha Stewart, is doing a comparative assessment of in terms of their business empires of Martha Stewart and Oprah. Another student who's in economics is comparing Oprah with Rupert Murdoch and Ted Turner because of their, you know, building their empires within the context of cable. So, and then other people are looking at images, you know, body image, because that has been such a focus on Oprah's show.
Yeah. Another person I think of when I think of Oprah is Robert Johnson.
Ah, yes.
Is anybody studying the history or the impact of magazines like Ebony and Jet and Essence?
This gets back to the fact that African American business history has been relatively unexplored. People have just not thought, you know, about blacks in business. And again, I emphasize, because that particular aspect of black history has been ignored, we have had a history that has developed that has been incomplete, and has, because of the omission of certain aspects of that history, it has become a distorted history. And but getting back to the question, there have been few biographies or autobiographies of black entrepreneurs. John H. Johnson, for example, has an autobiography that's co-written by Lerone Bennett, as an example. Madam C.J. Walker, who is the first black woman to have millions of dollars in business receipts, her biography was recently published by her great-great-granddaughter, Alilia Bundos. The first black to have a enterprise that had more than $1 billion in receipts was Reginald Lewis. Now, and this is important, why it is so necessary to begin reconstructing, at least from some kind of scholarly perspective, of what the history of black entrepreneurship has been about. Reginald Lewis, through his leveraged buyout of Beatrice International, was able to, and he had majority interest and control of one of the major international companies owned by blacks, earning, once he started, as much as $3 billion in business receipts. So he died in 1993. Now, while he lived, he was in, you know, the popular media, Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, New York Times. But you can ask young students at the University of Illinois today, they have no idea who Reginald Lewis is. Many of them know something about John H. Johnson because they look at Ebony and Jet. They know about Madam C.J. Walker because there was a stamp on you know, about her. But there have been black entrepreneurs over time. I'd like to give you an example of one. His name was Free Frank.
A relative of yours.
He was born a slave in 1771. And in South Carolina, taken to Kentucky, and eventually became a slave who hired his own time. Now, this is the difference. Many slave owners would hire their slaves out, say, for $120 a year. But a slave who hired his own time would go to his owner and say, if you let me hire my own time, I will pay you $240 a year. So the owner got more with the slave hiring his own time. Free Frank set up a saltpeter manufactory in Kentucky, and eventually purchased his wife, then he purchased himself, and continued purchasing family members until he died in 1854 and left money. And altogether, some 16 family members were purchased. In fact, he came to Illinois in 1830 and became the first African-American town founder when he established New Philadelphia, Illinois, in Pike County. And so that was what set me off exploring black entrepreneurship, because I knew that Free Frank was not the only one. But here's a man who worked his whole life to buy his family, beginning in 1817, and with money left in his, mm-hmm. you know, he was able to buy more after the estate was settled in 1857. That's 40 years. That gives an indication of, you know, what the institution was about property. And here is an individual buying his own children. If that doesn't say anything about the need for reparations, and I can prove.
It's a fascinating story, and you tell it in a book that you've written. And the title of the book, is it called Free Frank?
Yeah, Free Frank, a Black Pioneer on the Antebellum Frontier. It can be pulled up on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and, of course, at the University of Illinois bookstores.
Yeah, it's really a wonderful book. Mm-hmm. Is there going to be a book that comes out of your work in this course, Oprah?
Yeah. In fact, I have a book, a collection of articles that I'm editing that will be published by Prager Press. It's called Oprah, the Enterprise, Race, Culture, and the Media. And as far as my book that I'm writing on Oprah, so far I have like 6 publishers interested in the book. But the thing is, you know, should it be published as a scholarly book or a trade book?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's in their books on Oprah, but just how analytical are they in looking at her life, and especially looking at her life beyond, you know, her entertainment activities, but how Oprah stands in relationship to Black America in the post-civil rights era. What does Oprah represent? This is what I want to do with the book.
I think both of those, either one of those takes, the scholarly take or mm-hmm. the trade take, mm-hmm. I bet both of those would be successful, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to write two.
I'm only going to do one. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us this afternoon, Professor. Professor Juliet Walker has been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She's teaching a course at the University of Illinois this semester titled Oprah Winfrey, the Tycoon.